It's time for Valley Edition, a weekly panel discussion on current issues in the Mat-Su Valley, moderated by Mike Malevsky.
We're ready for another edition of Valley Edition. I have here in the studio two stalwart panelists. I've sometimes wondered what stalwart really means. Mark Kelsey, welcome, Mark.
Good morning.
And Terry Snyder, welcome, Terry.
You're making me wonder too, Mike.
And then out there in the world, another stalwart panelist calling in, Zaz Hollander.
Welcome. Good morning, everybody.
Good morning. Well, let's kick off with something that happened early today. I was blithely going along with the morning show, and suddenly, over our broadcast signal came an interrupted tsunami warning that went on at some length, talking about a tsunami warning not only for Alaska, but parts of a little over 48. And I had a call then from someone who's in a car who said, I've just heard this tsunami warning. And I thought, something about that, it felt more like a test. But so I checked quickly, and I went out to all of the sites that I normally do, and I saw no indication that there was a tsunami in play. I then called the Tsunami Warning Center, and they answered quickly, as they typically do. And I said, well, what's up? And they said, well, it's not a tsunami. It's
fake news.
Well, basically they said this was intended, and I'm not sure the origin of the test. These tests originate in a variety of different ways. But as a test, it somehow came across as a real warning without a test introduction, etc. And when we look at our logs, and we have a device here which sends out the signal, takes it from other stations and the internet, I could see that it indeed did not carry any proviso that said, oh, test, test, test. Hmm. So they are, as I just before we started talking here, I checked once again the Tsunami Warning Center's news, and they said they're still following up. They're trying to figure out perhaps whose finger was to blame. Mm-hmm. And of course, this brings back the memory of an event I think most prominent that happened in Hawaii not so long ago, where someone sent out in this case, it happened to be missiles rather than a tsunami. So, Zaz, any addition that you have to what I have just summarized?
No, I'm busily writing down what you just said, Mike, because I think that our listeners are hearing sausage being made, because I'm trying to talk with different radio stations around the state to find out what message they got. And so originally this morning when I started seeing chatter about this warning that wasn't, I thought, well, I don't know if this is a story. And then I started talking with people, regular people, who had in fact seen warnings and then did what Mike did, gone to their earthquake apps on their phone and said, I see a 5.2, but that's not enough for a tsunami. There's no tsunami warnings out there. And there were no, as far as I can tell, sirens that actually went off in at least a couple coastal communities I called Seward and Kodiak. But and again, as you said, Mike, it sounds like the tsunami warning folks by the Weather Service and state emergency alert system officials are still figuring out what happened. This is technical. The technical side is probably something Mike understands better than I do, but it sounds like there was something lost in the translation between the Tsunami Warning Center, which issues these. It was described to me as a communications test.
Right.
They do them every month and have for years. And so as far as the center was concerned, that's what they did. They didn't see anything different. They didn't put out anything different. And then they started getting all these phone calls from people who were like, is there? What's going on? And that's when they realized there was an issue. I've seen a few emails that at least, and this is all very preliminary, it's 10 a.m. on Friday when we're taping, but that seemed to indicate that it was the emergency alert system where maybe the test warning dropped off. But again, I don't have anything to establish that. It just seems to be what a few media representatives are wondering about. But either way, I've seen or heard of at least two alerts that went out. A woman I talked with said she saw one on TV just after 7 and then heard another one on the radio at like 7:45. And neither of them had a test attachment to it. So I would imagine we'll know more by the time people are hearing our Friday broadcast.
And of course, for listeners and panelists who are not aware exactly how it works, we have a device sitting here in our studio, which is called an NDEC. And basically, it listens to two areas. We're listening to other radio stations, and when a message goes out, it cascades through stations. And as we hear the over-air, we repeat that. The code turns on our system to repeat the broadcast. We have also, in addition, an internet-based connection as well. So the image that I'd like to say that is interesting here is that once it goes out, it cascades through. Okay. And so it once again becomes incumbent upon whoever is sending a message out or wherever it enters the system, if it enters the warning system, that be properly coded. Now, much of this is automatic, and I don't know the details well enough to tell you whether the Tsunami Warning Center's test was just following a protocol that achieved, and there had been some change in one way in the system, and that will come out later on. But it speaks to the, interesting question whenever a news of an event, a break in the normal happens, how if there is a start that is in error and there isn't fact-checking along the way, whether they're editors or whether someone looks at it and says, does this make sense, and then passes it along, how news can spread widely, especially these days with social media, et cetera, mm-hmm. And you're down the road. On the other hand, as I'm saying this, pops into my mind the image so often displayed in movies of the 7th of December, 1941, in Pearl Harbor, where people had news and sort of said, that's real news, but it doesn't seem to fit our pattern of what should be happening. Whether it's something that is extraordinary and we just have not seen it before, it gets tagged with the wrong real or fake aspect. We have to, fortunately, follow up pretty quickly, and we do that immediately to say, is that real? And check our other sources.
And so, Mike, if I can interrupt you, what did you do after you talked with the center and they said there's no tsunami? Were you able to back off the warning or cancel it somehow?
Well, understand the way this works. The warning had already gone out. It happens automatically. Yeah. So I had heard it, and that what precipitated my checking. And checking other sites and calling the warning center. So as soon as I called them, then I went on the air. We were still on the air. And I told people that warning that had been heard that may have sounded like it was real was not. Mm-hmm. And so that's the best we can do. It's already out there. And you have to chase it down and say, just telling you at this point, the reality is we've checked with the Tsunami Warning Center. Somehow that warning went out. And the danger, of course, is this. The system is designed to alert people, and if there are too many false alerts, people, Mark.
Yeah, how much time passed between the warning and the correction?
In my case, it took me about 10 minutes to check everything down and make sure I was sure about it and then went out with it. So it's possible, and of course, when people are watching a stream of news, whatever is their source, are they still driving their vehicle down the road and they got the first information? Where are they in their lives that they're still listening to listen for corrections? But that's about the time that happened, yes.
So is it a hackable system? Can somebody hack in and set off an alarm? Will they be able to find out what went wrong?
I suspect, as they did in Hawaii, and we have also had I would say, bumps in the road in a variety of ways. This system has been in existence for a long time, the emergency alert system, and it's continually being fine-tuned and fixed, et cetera. Our system here is the piece, the device sits here. What we do is we do upgrades in our firmware to ensure that it works mm-hmm. properly. But back in other places, I'm sure there are fine-tunings. And with anything that is involving data systems and so on, you could have a situation emerge where this kind of thing could happen. I can tell you that there's a lot of interest in making sure this works right. And sure. I expect over the next few days to hear a lot about how this is being traced down. Yes. Okay. So, Zaz, that's where we are.
Okay, good. Well, I'm going to bow out to get back to trying to find out what happened here. And if I I'll send you guys a text if I find out anything informative in the next few minutes.
Okay. Excellent. Thank you very much.
Okay. Take care, everybody.
Yes. Okay, so back to, well, shall we call it the real world?
You must want to be talking about Juno then.
Well, let's start with Juno, because as we are speaking at this time, and each day, each hour brings us closer to finality, and as best I can tell, the pieces are falling into some form of a finished puzzle. And what we're seeing now is pretty much the outline of what is happening. In terms of the decisions regarding an operating budget, that's pretty much finished. If you want to say capital budget, then you have to listen carefully because there's not much there.
Well, there's two big objects there.
Oh, yeah. Like, well, relatively speaking to nothing, but not to years past. Go ahead.
Well, there's money put in there for the Juno Road. And there's money put in there for the Kinnick Arm Bridge. So I don't think that part's gotten out of the house yet. But is that in conference committee now? I think it might be.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think the final details are being worked out in conference committee. And quick, build on Mike's point that it's almost finished. I would say it's almost finished for now. There are still big decisions, obviously, that will need to be made down the road. But as far as, getting a current budget done so that the legislature can adjourn and get out of town, those details are all but done. I think they had a $10.5 billion budget, which includes, $2.5 billion in deficit, although it's being covered mostly by permanent fund, and then a little bit that remains in the constitutional budget reserve. But it was not all cuts of certainly to local interest. The university system got a $10 million increase. Not sure if that was specific to programs or just a general fund addition, but I know that the university officials are very happy about that. On the flip side, there was a cut to Medicaid, which will have a domino effect on federal funds that come to the state. So, these are things that are fixes for this year that are probably not sustainable in the long term. So it'll be, back at it for the new
legislature,
new folks in January.
Yeah. So one of the interesting questions, though, and perhaps Mark, you can speak to this, has to do with the price of oil. What we've noticed as a result of some growing tension in the Middle East and the possibility of Iran not dumping oil on the markets or selling on the markets as much, price of oil has tended to move up. This has a lot of different effects for people. But one, of course, that affects us is that the higher the price of oil, the smaller our own deficit. As a budget is prepared, my understanding is that there's a projection here about how much money is going to come from oil. And if it happens to go up, then that deficit goes down. And that could happen this coming year.
It could happen, and that seems to have been, the plan B for many folks in Juneau, hoping that the price rebounds enough to cover some of the deficit. We don't know for sure, but I think long-term projections are certainly not seeing anything like we had a few years back with, up close to $100 prices. Those days, by all accounts, are gone. But yes, there's certainly the possibility that an increase could help the state's fiscal woes.
Okay.
Well, also, it's just another reflection on the fact it's not a sustainable plan. None of this is. It's an election year. You have to leave the come back, and they're going to have to campaign. They're going to have to explain why they took some of the permanent fund. It's a hard thing for people to understand. There's a lot of mistrust about taking any money from that, even though there is some certainty for the next year. There's no certainty beyond next year. Beyond that, everybody is you will know they'll get a $1,600 PFD this year, but that's only next year or this fall. And also, you know, right now the cards are sort of playing well for oil because they have an administration that wants to drill, 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 which is what everybody's been counting on too. And we could be very close to war in the Middle East, which, again, you know, favors oil. But it's not a sustainable pattern. And I think what makes me sad about it is that it kind of makes the state procrastinate on a backup plan because there's no the urgency to conserve goes away. Nobody, I'm surprised that the price of gas at the pumps is pretty high right now, over $3, $3.25, I think. I'm surprised no one's screaming about that. When it reached up over $2, people were screaming. Now they've just adjusted to the fact that that's how much gas is going to be. And that has to be affecting the commuters that are going back and forth and the money they're able to spend here in the Valley. There's a gas tax in Anchorage. All of that certainly has an impact on most people. So it's going to be a very interesting to see what the dialogue is as we go into the silly season, as Mike and I always talk about it, because it's going to be nothing but full throttle campaign from here, from Saturday, if they do it during Saturday evening, which it's sounding like, until the primaries in August and then beyond until their general election in November.
Okay, let's finish up with any further news that you might have about Juneau finishing a couple of bills you've been watching carefully. Any update on that?
Yeah, so SB 63, which I've talked about a lot about here, the smoke-free workplace bill, I'm hearing still has a fairly good chance of going to the floor in some form, whether it is the form that was intended, which is basically what we have here in Palmer that protects people in their workplace from secondhand smoke, whether it be electronic cigarettes or marijuana. And there's no option. You have to abide by it. There were some things put in the bill in the Rules Committee. The Rules Chair, Gabrielle Ladeau, has been sitting on that particular bill for weeks now and not letting it out of Rules, even though it's got 22 supporters on it, to go to the floor for a House vote. But it sounds like there is some feeling that it may squeak out this year, still at the very end. Breeze Law is another one that has been talked about a lot. I don't hear as much positive on that one, that it may make it through the gauntlet. But there's a lot of pressure down there for those two bills to get out. Lots of support. It'll be a very sad day for Alaska, I think, if those two bills don't get out of committee with such overwhelming support from the public. So little fiscal impact, none on the smoke-free bill, and none really on Breeze Law that they found out. So here's things that only save lives, help Alaskans deal with social problems, help our Medicaid budget, which they've cut, and insurance for people, and they've turned their back on two bills that could actually do that. The alcohol bill looks dead. This is an alcohol reform bill that's been kicking around. We've had the same alcohol rules since the 70s. That looks to be dead this year. A lot of wasted effort on a lot of bills that could have actually had some good repercussions either way.
So I just want to ask you, you've been following smoking for a long time. There are two things that came up recently that I was intrigued by. One is the beginning use of what is referred to as third-hand smoke.
Mm-hmm. We've always known about that.
Yeah, but we haven't. I haven't heard it spoken a lot about. And so I'm saying, would you explain to Mark what third-hand smoke is?
Well, that's if you are in the workplace and you get secondhand smoke on you because somebody's smoking in the workplace and you take it home and carry your baby around and they get the third hand smoke. And the science is very strong on it. It's just not talked about very much.
Wow.
But, you know, you get it in your carpet and your baby crawls on your carpet because you're in a smoky environment all day long working. Even though you're not a smoker, you're bringing your secondhand smoke home and you're leaving it in your home and you're exposing people to it. So
okay.
It's that.
And what's the holdup on the alcohol bill?
You know, there was a good article in the ADN about that today. They were trying – it's Peter Michicki again, who actually is the sponsor of the Smoke-Free Workplace Bill too. He was trying to do some reform on trying to meld the brewery business, the tasting brewery business, together with regular bars. There's a really good article in the AD, and I recommend people to read about. There were a lot of stakeholders. They worked on it for a couple of years. I can see both sides of it. I really can. CHAR, who is also, is, you know, an organization that's for the bars and the liquor establishments, came out very strong against smoke-free, and they came out swinging on this one, too.
Yeah, I wondered if there was a relation there.
And basically, mm-hmm. as I understand the issue, when we have a craft brewery, for example, mm-hmm. that wishes to sell...
It's tasting room. Which already have rules. They can't be open beyond 8
sure.
o'clock. They can't serve food. They can't have entertainment.
But there's been some sense that perhaps this, as I understand,
cutting into their business.
It cuts into the business of the mom-and-pop bars that exist in...
Right. And then there's the overall evidence of what impact alcohol has in our state and what the social consequences of that are. But I think the most interesting part of that bill for me is that, and again, read the article, but it's there was some angst with people saying that the two legislators, House legislators, that former bar owner and a present bar owner, came out against the bill. But as somebody pointed out, you know, we have people sitting in the legislature. We don't have a full-time legislature. We have a citizenry legislature. They have their own special interests. We have people that work for oil companies that vote on oil bills all the time. So to preclude somebody who works in the industry, you know, not to sit on a committee looking at a liquor bill, we have to decide what we want in legislators.
Well, how will the new ethics bill affect that?
I don't know. Have you been following that? I haven't been following that.
Not a lot been said about it in several weeks. It seemed to be headed for passage to, you know, head off the initiative, but I have not seen a lot about it since then.
We'll have
then.
To spend a little more time once we get the detail.
Yeah. Well, you know, and that is sort of a silly thing when people get up and say they want to excuse themselves and they don't have to, they just, somebody says, one person can object, and they virtually shouldn't even do it, because I've never seen anybody say, he needs to be or she needs to be excluded from a vote. I've never in the history of watching the legislature. So it's, you know,
okay.
It's all show.
So next question, when is a USB stick not a USB stick? And I'm talking about this in regard to smoking.
Oh, yeah, the vape pins, yeah.
Juul, yes. For those who are not familiar with this, what has been developed, technology is a wonderful thing, is something that looks like a USB stick but contains a fruity, or your choice of flavor, hit of nicotine that can be charged in your laptop. Mm-hmm. The concern that people have, and I suspect that if it hasn't already been discussed at the legislative level, it will be coming up, because it's very, very difficult to determine, as compared to having a pack of cigarettes or even some vaping gear, that that's what you have. So the concern is that younger people have the USB stick or two, one that contains data, the other one, which is a smoking device, and it's hard to find. It's misleading in the sense that targeted very attractive flavors of peppermint, bubblegum, you pick it.
Well, it's nicotine, and they're not regulated at all. The electronic cigarette industry is not regulated, and there's little chance it will be regulated at this point. And the science and the data that shows that kids are getting hooked on cigarettes, not on cigarettes, but on nicotine through these devices, is pretty startling. It's sort of a replay of the way nicotine really came into play in our society. They put them in GI packs back in the war, World War II, I think, and got everybody hooked on nicotine that way with free cigarettes. And this one, although they say they are manufacturing them to get adults off of cigarettes, that's not what the data is showing. What the data is showing is that kids are getting hooked on nicotine. And they're showing up on airplanes, in airplane bathrooms. They're using them. There's a whole sites that tell you how to hide your Juul smokes. I've heard people having them in theaters and kids in classrooms. It's a pretty scary thing, and it's just a road that we don't need to go down. And they need some regulation, and I don't think we have right now the political will to make that happen. It's going to take an education, just like we've spent millions of dollars and continue to do on educating kids and adults on the on secondhand smoke and what nicotine does to them and what the costs are.
Mark, you had a question?
Just curious why the unwillingness to address it if the science is clear.
Money. Lobbyists. The cigarette, the the backers of electronic cigarettes are big tobacco. They know that, I mean, the evidence of adult smoking, actual, you know, finger and hand, in your hand, tobacco cigarettes is going down, down, down. People, it's becoming less socially acceptable. But these are becoming the new norm. And so that's where they're put, the lobbyists are putting their money in. The people that are fighting the smoke-free workplace bill in Juneau right now are tobacco lobbyists and spreading data that's unproven, and because they want electronic cigarettes in there. That's what it's about, is money and lobbyists.
We've got a very short time left, and we want to address a change that happened recently at Palmer City Council level. Longtime council member Brad Hansen resigned and has taken a position with the city as the economic development director. That'll be made official at the next meeting that happens in a couple of weeks. And then the process at that point will be for the council to announce an opening, a two-week period of time where individuals who live within the city of Palmer may put in their application tell why they think they should be appointed to the remaining few months until the October election. At that point, if that person who's been appointed, and the way the process will work, as the mayor has outlined for us, is to basically take all those candidates who meet the basic criteria of as residency, and they will appear before the council in open session. The council will ask those candidates questions, and then the council will vote in open session on who they think should be a member. So if there are seven people that apply, it might take a while. If there's one person or two people, it might happen quickly. And then upon selection, where there are four members of the council who vote yes for a single person.
Four out of six.
Four out of six has to be four. In fact, actually, four for anything.
Yeah.
They have to be at least four, and in some cases a super plurality of five. But in any case, that's the situation, and then the person would be seated at the subsequent meeting once they've been chosen. However, that's not the end of the story, because they only get to serve for a few months, and then in October, there will be an election, which will be selecting new people or replacing people with incumbents for two of the seats on the council, with a secondary selection and balloting specifically for the remaining 2 years of Mr. Hansen's term. So you would, if you were living here and you wanted to be on the council, you'd have to make a choice. Do I run for one of the 2 3-year term seats where winner takes all, or do I contend for the 2-year seat? Mm-hmm. So there'll be actually two groups of people working at that.
So what is the earliest, did the mayor say, what's the earliest you could have somebody seated in the temporary seat?
To officially occupy that seat, given that the announcement will be made for 6 weeks from now.
Wow.
6 weeks. Because the next meeting will be the acceptance.
So end of June, probably.
Yeah, the next meeting at the end of May is the acceptance of the resignation and the announcement of the two-week period. So you go out 2 weeks, and then it'll be 2 weeks before the people come in, and then they won't be actually seated until 2 weeks after. So my numbers say 6 weeks from today, which takes us to the end of June.
Right, which is right before the deadline to file for borough office, period.
Right. So you'd have to decide, am I going to do this? What am I going to do?
And is there any talk of hats being thrown in the ring yet? And
I have not heard any.
Yeah, there's certainly power in the incumbency normally, though. So it would be surprising if somebody, even if they had to run in 2 years, it's going to be a really interesting thing to follow.
Okay, we've run out of time. Once again, it's time to end this edition of Valley Edition. We look forward to next week for another time when we gather. I want to thank Mark Kelsey for coming in today.
Always good to be here.
I want to thank Terry Snyder for also coming in. And I want to thank Zaz Hollander, as she has gone off to do other work, for calling in today. Thank you all very much.
You've been listening to Valley Edition, a weekly panel discussion on current issues in the Matsu Valley, moderated by Mike Malevsky. Valley Edition is a production of Radio Free Palmer, recorded at our studios in Palmer, Alaska. The views and opinions of hosts or guests do not necessarily represent those of Radio Free Palmer, this station, or its underwriters. If you have any comments or questions about this program, email manager@radiofreepalmer.org.